Well, good morning again. It's a pleasure to be with you again. I have to say, it's such a pleasure to have children serving up here on the altar. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. You know, our lessons during this long season after Pentecost, which goes for about 6 months, starts on the Sunday after Trinity Sunday, which comes right after Pentecost, and goes all the way up to Advent. It's all about discipleship and how we might become better disciples and walk more effectively, if you will, in our sandals next to Jesus as he travels and does his ministry and so forth. But at the same time, the Old Testament lessons we're hearing are sort of what we call semi-continuous. We're hearing these great stories of the Old Testament, but they don't necessarily have any theological theme that matches what we hear in the Gospel. They're just stories, and we need to hear those. And then, of course, we're hearing from Paul, and Paul is always off on his own doing something. So the point I'm getting at, there's no real theological theme that runs through these lessons and connects them and holds them together. But what I have found in my reading and research for the sermon this morning is something a little different than a theological theme, and that is the struggle that we all have as human beings, as men and women, boys and girls, to know ourselves, but also to know what our relationship with God is like. So in the Old Testament lesson this morning, we hear about Jacob. And we've been hearing about Jacob for several Sundays in the Old Testament lesson. And you know, Jacob is no model of faith. If you don't know that, you should. He's a cheat. He's a liar. He's a conniver. He stole his older brother's birthright. And if you remember when the two of them were born, they were twins. Esau came out first, and Jacob was holding his ankle. So he's not a particularly amiable person. And yet, like David, the great king of the Hebrew people, who had his own problems, that's exactly who God comes to. People who are human, they're not perfect. And so in that lesson this morning, we're told that Jacob is at the ford in the Jabbok River, which is a tributary of the Jordan. I think it flows from east to west, maybe 20 miles north of the Dead Sea. And it's nighttime, and he's alone because he sent everybody else across the river, including his two wives and all the rest. And he starts to kind of reflect and think about his life. And I want to read to you a portion from a book that was published about 20 years ago called Wrestling with Angels. It's by an author named Naomi Rosenblatt, who's a psychotherapist. And what else is she? A lecturer, but she's also an adult Bible class teacher. And at one point in her life, she actually taught a weekly Bible study for U.S. senators at our Capitol in Washington. Don't you think we should send her back? So she's got a lot of practical experience. She's not an Ivy League theologian. But listen to what she says about Jacob. When we are alone in the stillness of the night, we face our worst fears and our deepest wishes. It is often at these dark moments that we discover who we really are. When we reach deep within ourselves for guidance or call out to a higher power for comfort, we find out if we are truly alone or in the company of others, our ancestors, our personal angels, our God. Jacob has reached the terminus of his homeward journey. He won't uncover the intent of his brother's heart until the next morning, that's Esau. But this night, on the eve of that fateful reckoning, Jacob will take stock of where he has been and what he has become. He is finally ready to face the spirits that haunt his waking and sleeping soul, and he is determined to test the limits of his power to overcome them. Jacob is struggling as a person to where he is to go. We're told that a man comes, and Jacob wrestles with him the whole night. We're also told later in the lesson, I believe, that he believed that to be the face of God, And we would believe, I think, that it was an angel, and therefore he saw the face of God and did not die. And he wrestled with the man, and he kept asking the man for a blessing. And the man finally gave him the blessing, but the cost he had for the blessing was he got his hip broke. It's a strange story. There's things underneath this story that we don't know about and probably can't retrieve because it's so long ago. He didn't escape injury in order to get the blessing, and otherwise he had to make a sacrifice. He had to struggle. And often we can neither see the face nor know the name of what confronts us in the night. We struggle, just like Jacob, to know who we are, where we're going, and what our own destiny is. The epistle lesson this morning is a continuous or semi-continuous reading from Romans. We've been hearing the last few Sundays from chapter 8. Now we're into chapter 9. And the lesson is very clear that Paul is struggling with the situation he's in. The Hebrew people, do not accept Christ as the promised Messiah who's to come from the Hebrew people, which he mentions at the end of the lesson. They have failed to accept Christ, and yet Paul still reaffirms his ancestral faith home. He's part of that. He was a persecutor of Christians before he became one himself. He was a Pharisee, one of the elite of the Jewish establishment. So he has that ancestral tradition. So Paul struggles with what he is to do and what is his destiny, because he eventually became, as you and I well know, the main missionary of the early church. Without Paul, it may have been that Christianity would not have survived at all. Well, then we come to the gospel, and there's a struggle going on here too. I love to call this season after Pentecost boots on the ground season, because it's very practical and down to earth. It's also, for me, maybe some of you, a summer of my and maybe our discontent. There's something in the land that's not right. We've got a do-nothing Congress. We have found out recently that, courtesy of the Florida legislature, we now have gerrymandered congressional districts, a couple of domestic political things. But also beyond that, there's the terrible things that are going on between the Israelis and Hamas as they struggle with each other. Some of the things I've seen on television and photos I've seen have brought tears to my eyes. The helplessness of these victims, these civilians. I remember one that struck me, maybe you saw it too, the baby that was born by C-section because the house collapsed on her mother and she was killed. And then 3 days or 4 days later, it's on the news, there's that little baby wrapped in cloth going to be buried too. It's enough to, I don't know how to describe it, it's enough to make you think there's not hope or something. The world doesn't feel comfortable, it feels very threatening. It's almost like a tinderbox, something new is going to happen tomorrow. 100 years ago, on the eve of World War I, we also had a tinderbox. I don't mean to be too overdramatic this morning, but something really seems broken in our country and in our world, and there doesn't seem to be much light at the end of the tunnel, and little hope. But having thought about that and said that, and being a bit of a historian, we need to remember a few things. It's also true that in our nation, 150 years ago, 1864, we Americans slaughtered each other in the worst year of the Civil War. It was unbelievable what was going on. And in the sense of strife and conflict, either at home or abroad, our world is the same world as the world of thousands of years ago, or hundreds of years ago, or just decades ago. The world of the Old and the New Testaments is certainly full of strife, conflict, and suffering. Two Sundays ago, both Jesus and the Apostle Paul taught us that there is no final end to suffering. There will be no final end to suffering until the eschaton, the end of time, when Jesus comes back and wraps us all up and makes all things new. In the meantime, between now and then, God has made the world in a way that does not allow us to escape our time and our place in which we live. We have to deal with the world the way it is. In the gospel reading, Jesus has to deal with something. The sentence or two that come before our gospel reading this morning is the news that Jesus receives that his cousin John the Baptist has been beheaded by the civilian ruler, well, he's partially Jewish, Herod. And so our gospel reading then begins. What does Jesus do when he hears this news? Well, we're told that he flees in a boat by himself out to a deserted place. And you might ask the question, well, is he afraid that Herod will now come after him and do the same with his head? Or is Jesus grieving over the death of John, one of his cousins, a family? Sure. Is Jesus reflecting on what ultimately happens to all real prophets? That is, they're gotten rid of by the powers of the world? Matthew doesn't tell us what Jesus' motivation was. But maybe Matthew doesn't have to tell us that. Maybe Jesus goes away alone for all those reasons. He's suffering. The fact that he needs to go away and be by himself after a tragedy, is so, for me, so very human. The lesson this morning is really about the human side of Jesus, that side of him which is all full of compassion. But his need to go away. But regardless of what's happening to him, his tragedy in his life, in his time and place, the gospel lesson tells us that the world still finds Jesus. When he gets out of the boat, what does he see? A crowd waiting for him. They've come by foot from all the towns because apparently they've seen him go out and they're going to follow him and find out where he is. Now, I'm going to be a little loose now. I'm going to move back and forth between the gospel reading as it's written and putting us, you and I, today's disciples, into that reading. For you and I are in that crowd. Just like that crowd who's out there hungry for curing of the sick, for healing, for spiritual knowledge. We're part of that crowd too. We want help. We want help to deal with the world of conflict, of the violence and the suffering that we see and experience just as the original crowd did. Jesus could have left and found some other deserted place or at least tried to, but no, he doesn't do that. Instead, he confronts it. He goes to the crowd. And the crowd represents the world, and Jesus goes ashore to challenge the world. And he has compassion for that crowd, you and I. He cures the sick, and curing of the sick represents more than just that. It represents and reflects all of the crowd's needs and all of our needs. But you know, we're not only part of that crowd, we're part of the disciples too who show up at night. Just like Jacob, it's night. Followers of Jesus, we're in training to do what Jesus does, and we finally show up, it's evening, and we too must have heard, as the original disciples heard, that Jesus was curing the sick somewhere over there on the beach. We arrive, is it better late than never? What are we going to do? Well, not initially. The first thing the disciples do is suggest to Jesus that the crowds be sent away. Send them into the villages, Jesus, so they can buy food for themselves. Or in our time, go up to the fast food places at the I-75 interchange. Let them get something to eat. Like all the disciples of Jesus through the ages, we want to help. We may be late, but we want to help. We see the dilemma. It's evening. There's a large crowd. There's no food. And the fact of the matter is, we really don't know what to do, but we want to help. So we suggest to Jesus that those in need go get their needs met somewhere else because we can't help. Jesus doesn't buy that we can't help. He says to the disciples, they, meaning the crowd, 5,000 men plus women and children. You might wonder why women and children is tagged on in the gospel lesson. Well, that's probably because most of the time women and children weren't paid attention to at all. Matthew's taken a step in the right direction. That crowd, they need not go away. Father Ralph, you and the rest of the disciples, give him something to eat. But Jesus, we have nothing here. All we have is 5 loaves and a cup of fish. We know that next Jesus looks up to heaven, as we all should when we're struggling. And he takes and he blesses and he breaks and he gives, paralleling what he does at the Last Supper and what we will do later in this worship service at the communion part. He takes, he blesses, he breaks, and he gives what food there is to the disciples, the resources that are available, who in turn, as his followers, give it to the crowd. The physical needs of the crowd, as well as their spiritual needs, curing the sick, feeding the hungry, those needs are met. But there's something that's equally as important, and that is the spiritual needs of both the crowd and the disciples are met also, which is part and a big part of the understanding of this miracle story. Through Jesus and then through the disciples, you and me, God's love is shown in a tangible way. The people are cared for, compassion is shown to them, attention is shown to them. As disciples, we should and need to remember that the miracles of Jesus, whatever they are, in this case, 5 loaves, 2 fish, feeding many, many people, these miracles are not intended to impress us or astonish us. Rather, the miracles are signs to the crowd which we are a part of, and to us as disciples, of our responsibility to demonstrate God's love for humanity in visible and positive ways. We are to do good. In the feeding of the 5,000, the disciples, as well as Jesus, touched the people. And we're told later in the lesson that all ate and all were filled. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.